Accession number 19104, Reel 3.
Major Brown, Reel 3.
And every day we flew up and down the southern end of this demilitarized zone, seeing if anybody was coming in from the other side, which all seemed to be a little pointless.
But before the armistice, you said you thought there didn't seem point to it. Did you mean because simply the campaign was a stalemate which should have ended, or because you didn't see a political point in the first place in intervening in Korea?
I originally would have said it was the stalemate, and the fact that having reached that stalemate, the Panmunjom exercise should have happened very, very much earlier. On reflection, I think that politically, I'm not sure that the Korean War should have gone ahead in the form that it went ahead. I think the Korean War should either have gone right up to the North Korean border and then stopped. I wasn't very happy about finding that I was sitting there between two sections of country, and neither of whom really wanted me there.
Did you get that impression from the South Koreans?
Yes, I did. Yes.
What type of thing gave you that impression?
I think when we went down to Seoul, which was the first place one got to get to people, the South Koreans were very concerned with making as much out of the forces there as they could. I didn't get the feeling that they looked upon us being there defending them a great deal. They were far more concerned with what they could get out of us. And I think that I got the impression that went right the way up the structure. Right up through their government as well.
What they could get out of you from the point of view of high prices?
High prices, supplies, anything.
What about your living conditions in Korea?
Whilst the war was on, it was tents, it was little hooches that we built. When the war was over, our American friends very kindly provided us with the wooden boxes that they flew jet engines in to Korea from the States. And these made magnificent huts. And we got bulldozers in, bulldozed holes in the ground, lowered the wooden boxes in, and built the most magnificent huts. Everything was very comfortable indeed. But it seemed to be a little pointless.
And you said it wasn't just the British doing spotting work.
No, in the flight, we had a Canadian pilot and an Australian pilot, as well as the British. The Americans also had spotters, and the South Koreans had spotters as well.
Did the Americans and South Koreans have a different method of doing the job?
Yes, as I say, the South Koreans, I never saw a South Korean engaging with guns. I saw the Americans engaging with guns, but I say the American pilots were never allowed to make a correction. They merely reported where the rounds fell, because it was considered that the pilot was too junior officer to make a correction for the guns. It was always made back at the gun table on the ground. Whereas, from our point of view, we were experienced gun officers used to shooting guns. And had we been on the ground, we would have been doing exactly the same thing. We would have been correcting the guns if we'd been on the ground from an OP. Whereas we've been given an advantage, we put our OP in an aeroplane so we could see more. there was no reason why we should change our method of doing things. And I think it worked very much better.
When you were on the ground before the armistice, to what extent were you safe from bombardment?
There was the occasional mortaring, but north of the engine, just over the other side of the river. We understand that there was a man who did actually come right across our strip, a North Korean courier who used to run across our strip at night and go down to Seoul and pick up information. And there was one biplane flown by a North Korean who used to come right down over and down to Seoul. And in fact, he did some bombing, I think, on the airport, on the racetrack airfield at Seoul at night. But apart from that, it wasn't that kind of hectic war. Certainly they were out there because we had our flight at one end of the strip, and we had a light liaison flight at the other end of the strip. And the light liaison flight lost a pilot who was there doing a leaflet drop. And he made the mistake of forgetting about the wind, and the wind blew him well over the other side, and they shot him down. He went into the bag.
And so then you did your second stretch in Malaya.
Yes, I came back. I came back at that stage. My flight had moved from Benta to Taiping, because they used to rotate the flights in the Malaya. And I came back to 1907 flight again, which was in Taiping.
And when did your spell in Malaya finish, the second one?
1955.
And what happened to you in the rest of your career?
That was the end of my aircraft career. I came back to England hoping to go to Staff College. Didn't go to Staff College. I was sent, in fact, to the on an instructor in gunnery course at Manmanabir, and I became an instructor in gunnery. Subsequently, in 1960, when I'd gone back to Penang with my regiment, I did get a call from the Army Air Corps to go back and do a second tour. They wanted me to go back and be second in command of the Malayan squadron. But when I went down to Kuala Lumpur to meet the new CO, he was not very keen because he already had a second in command in mind, and he wanted me to go back and be a flight commander, as I'd already done that several years before, and I was told I was going to get my battery. It was considered by everybody that career-wise I should stay a gunner as opposed to go back to flying. So I never went back again.
Now, 1969, I think you were in Libya when the coup occurred.
That's right.
Can you tell me about your spell in Libya and what happened there?
Yes, I came out of the army in 69 and took a job with British Aircraft Corporation to run a school for surface-to-air missiles in Libya for King Idris. Just previously, when I was in the army, I had been the air defense advisor on a trade mission that went out there. And I was offered a job that I couldn't really refuse. In September 69, I went out specifically from Stevenage to do some reconnaissance for radar sites. I'd been out there for 1 or 2 days. And I came down one morning to get into my jeep, provided by the Libyan army, to go and do some reconnaissance. And there was my driver, and sitting next to him was a man I hadn't seen before, in a boiler suit with 3 stripes chalked on his boiler suit. And they both had submachine guns. And my driver, who spoke English, said, "Please go back inside the hotel. If you don't, we have orders to kill you now." And I realized that I was in the middle of the coup. One of my students, for the first course at my new school during the next coming January, was a Captain Gaddafi, who had promoted himself to colonel overnight and had pulled a coup. I spent with everybody else 12 days either in the hotel or going to visit people in Tripoli jail, and then we were marched out into an aircraft, and that was it.
How long had you been in Libya for when that happened?
This was about my third month. I kept going from England out to Libya for 2 or 3 weeks and then coming back and doing work in Stevenage. And I was preparing to go out, I think, late November, December, permanently.
And I think you said you were declared persona non grata.
That's right. Everyone involved with that deal, who was on the ground at the time, were declared persona non grata and flown out on the first British aircraft that came in.
What had you been your experience in doing the job in the 3 months until the coup?
Only that I had been preparing the school. I'd been doing reconnaissance for sites. I'd been writing training documentation that was being printed in England. And I was awaiting the arrival of equipment to put in position.
And this was surface to air missiles?
This was a system which was a Thunderbird 2 surface-to-air missile system made by British Aircraft Corporation, basically. Corrupted slightly to meet the requirements of the RAF, who were also going to provide a fighter defence system on the ground. It was a very, very big Ministry of Defence contract, in fact. Very big one indeed.
Did you get to know Gaddafi?
Only that I saw him, he was identified to me as one of my potential students, that's all.
So you weren't able to wear him up?
No.
Did the coup take you by surprise, or had some...
Totally. As the day before the coup occurred, I'd been out on a recce. There was no obvious sign of a coup. There didn't appear to be any unrest or anything. Except that there were a lot more troops in the barracks. A concentration of vehicles, but there was no real reason to suppose it was going to be a coup. Even the Libyans I spoke to, the officers, gave no indication there was going to be a coup. It was a junior officer coup.
And whilst you were under house arrest, as it were, what was happening to you then, or what could you see of the situation in the city?
For a long time, it was very friendly. There was a large sign painted on the wall of the building opposite the hotel which said, "You are quite safe in our country." There was no... Apart from the fact that we were locked in, there appeared to be no animosity. But then somebody in London on a Friday afternoon at Prime Minister's question time asked whether it was true that the British government was selling tanks to Israel. And that message went through to Egypt, came back to Libya. And then we had a mob outside the hotel, and a mob, I'm told, outside the British Embassy.
What did they do?
They shouted and ranted, but nobody actually got hurt from the British side. From the Libyan side, I know they did, because several people that I was familiar with vanished off the face of the earth, I believe, to Benghazi jail.
Were the mob throwing things or trying to break into the hotel?
No, they just stood outside and chanted.
What had been Libyan attitudes towards you pre-coup?
Oh, extremely good. Very, very good indeed. The people that I was working with, the Libyans I was working with, I had had some of them over into England as part of the BAC build-up to the deal, so I knew them very well. It was a very, very, very cordial relationship. Very cordial relationship.
Had you ever come across hostility or coolness?
None. None. In fact, as I say, even the day before, apart from the fact that there appeared to be a lot more troops in barracks and vehicles were in barracks, there was nothing new.
Had you been optimistic about the project?
Oh, yes. Yeah. I was absolutely sure that the 7-year contract I'd got would go to another 7. I was so sure I was having a house built at Master's Lock on Malta, and my family were going to live either in Malta, they could live in Tripoli with me, but then go on vacation in Malta. I was so sure I was there.